Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This week's show is a Valentine addressed to Appalachia. We'll hear from writers who love it here and even feel drawn to these mountains. We'll talk with Neil Gaiman, who says some of his stories were inspired by Appalachian folktales.
Books of mine, like American Gods, in some ways began with my readings of the Appalachian folktales.
And Anne Pancake, who said while growing up in West Virginia, she always wanted to get as far away from Appalachia as she could. But when she did leave, her feelings for the mountains changed.
To grow up holding both, you know, that beauty and that loss and hurt develops this kind of paradoxical relationship to identity and to land that a lot of us have.
And we'll hear from a young activist and her complicated love for Appalachia.
I've gone outside the borders of this country. And I think what I realized was that while I was out doing this world-saving work everywhere else, like, there were needs where I'm from.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today on our show, in honor of Valentine's Day, we wanted to bring you voices from people who've written love letters for Appalachia, of a sort. And like most loves, this love, well, it's complicated. Some of the folks we'll hear on our show grew up in these mountains and were eager to move away. But when they did, they felt a strong homesickness that seemed to draw them back. And they realized that their love for Appalachia, well, it's a love for a place that isn't quite perfect, but they felt such a love for Appalachia they were inspired to write about it. But first, poet Nikki Giovanni loves several things about Appalachia. Its defense of freedom and how most people around here seem to know when enough is enough in regards to material wealth. Several of her books of poetry have been bestsellers, which she points out is unusual for a poet. In the 1960s and 70s, she helped lead the Black Arts Movement. They were a group of writers who were focused on encouraging a social and racial justice revolution through language and poetry. At the time, she was living in New York. She later began writing children's books and poems about her memories back in Knoxville, where she was born. After living in New York and becoming very famous, Giovanni returned to Appalachia in 1987 to live in Blacksburg and work at Virginia Tech. Here's Giovanni reading a poem called Knoxville, Tennessee.
I always liked summer best. You can eat fresh corn from Daddy's garden, and okra and greens and cabbage, and lots of barbecue and buttermilk and homemade ice cream at the church picnic, and listen to gospel music outside at the church homecoming, and go to the mountains with your grandmother, and go barefooted and be warm all the time, not only when you go to bed and sleep.
Last year, Nikki Giovanni read that poem during an interview with Liz McCormick.
I'm a Knoxvillian by birth, and I spent most of my summers with my grandmother, and then I actually moved in with my grandparents. So, yeah, I love this.
I love that poem, too. And can you talk a little bit about, in terms of Appalachia, how does this poem mean to you?
I just love it because, you know, there was always a garden. You always had something that your parents were growing, and I grew up being used to or having gardens, and of course I grew up also cooking with my grandmother, and grandmother would, you know, we'd go out and pick a tomato or go out and pick some peppers, or, you know, we'd always have something that we were putting from the garden into the food that we were actually eating. So it always made sense to me. I don't do, and I guess I shouldn't say that, but I don't do fast food. I know that whatever I do with a drive-through in a car is not food, so I don't do that, you know.
And so we don't have your poem, When God Made Mountains, to recite, but could you talk a little bit about it? And if you remember any specific parts of it that stick out to you, if you could just talk a little bit about that poem.
Well, I am actually a history major, so I've always been interested in how things evolve. And in thinking about West Virginia particularly, we cannot look at the history of the United States without recognizing the importance of West Virginia seceding from Virginia. The Civil War would have been an entirely different affair if the Union had lost control of these mountains, and we know that. And when God made mountains, I wanted to deal with why he was deciding to do that, aside from fresh water and stuff. He had to make a place, and of course you can't talk about the United States without talking about runaway slaves. And without these mountains, you know, this was the one place, West Virginia, that what became West Virginia, was the one place that a runaway slave, let's say you were coming up Alabama, you could come up and you could follow the water, and you could follow the water north. And in following the water north, you're going to get up here. These are going to be the people who are not going to turn you in. They're not going to turn you back. They're not going to sell you back. They're going to say welcome. Actually, as you know, West Virginia is quite rich, and yet West Virginians have not benefited from that. Almost everybody in the world has benefited from the richness of this state, from its wood to its forest to its oil to any number of things that are here. And yet West Virginians have not benefited from that. We have taken that away. And I think that one of the things that the country doesn't like is the fact that West Virginia stood up for freedom when nobody else was standing up for freedom, when it wasn't of benefit for them to stand up for freedom. It was the right thing to do. And I think the country's been upset with West Virginia ever since. Frankly speaking.
What was the initial kind of push for you to decide to express yourself through poetry in your, what you stand for in your activism and just expressing yourself? Why was it poetry that you chose?
I really don't know. It's just all I really know is what I dream and what I think. And, of course, people of my generation, we all, you know, picketed and we did the things that one should do, and that was a good thing to do, but I also just had these dreams, and I wanted to share them, and I had these ideas, and I kept thinking, something is missing. We have a bastardized history of West Virginia that has to be corrected, and it's time that West Virginians realize that we can't let other people say what our history is. We have to look at what it is. And I know the same thing is true of Black Americans, that we can't just look at what was done to us. We have to look at and what good came out of this. And so as we look at America, we have to look at what is marginalized and figure out what and who has been marginalized and how and why that happens.
What are some of your observations of race relations and civil rights in the Appalachian region compared to the rest of the country? And if you can give some similarities and some contrasts.
I think historically, Appalachians have been friends to freedom. And we can show that. And we show it through some things that are really quite easy. We show it through the banjo, because the banjo is endemic to West Africa. And so the only way that anybody in Appalachia can play a banjo that knows a banjo is that Africans or those who were enslaved and escaping came up here. We know things like okra, you know, came from Africa. And of course, I live in Virginia. I teach at Virginia Tech. And Virginia prides itself on being the peanut capital of the world. Well, peanuts or West African. And so whatever Virginia has learned about peanuts, they learned that through the people they enslaved. So we have a communication, and the communication has been good. We can look at how we dress, and we can look at how we dance. I think that if I may, the white Americans in Appalachia, here in West Virginia, in these mountains, have been a friend to freedom. And I think that it's time we celebrate it.
Continuing with kind of the idea of with civil rights and activism and race relations, looking at today with kind of the things that have been going on, police brutality, the Black Lives Matter movement, and the debate over the Confederate flag, and much more. Can you share some of your thoughts on what's going on today in our country?
Well, clearly some of it's sad. I have never understood the reason that policemen need guns. I still don't. And I, you know, the crooks will do whatever. But you don't need power and authority. Nobody does. And I have disliked the idea of policemen having guns because they already have authority. And somebody could call in and say, well, you know, Nikki, if the cops don't have guns, somebody will shoot them. But if the cops don't have guns, then the citizens will protect them. There's no question about that. And when we start to look at the inner cities particularly, we know, or we should know, that one of the things we want is we want the policemen, or the police people, I should say, to have a partner. We know that we don't want just the white policemen to be out there, a couple of them, and then they're shooting people for no reason. Everybody's upset. We want a white and a black. We want a man and a woman. We want a continual mix of who these people are. And as I said, we want them to be without without guns. The Confederate flag is a segregationist flag. What is being called the Confederate flag came up actually as a response to the civil rights, which shows both stupidity about who we are as a nation and who we are as a people. If I had my way, starting first grade, I'm sure first grade, every American child would learn another language. And I think that every American child, and I'm just not trying to speak for the world, but I think that every American child should know how to swim. It's just something that we should make sure that every kid in America, and I don't know if we have to even wait till first grade for that one, you know, and we need to get those kids there to teach them how to swim, because these are skills. I would like to see every American kid starting kindergarten, first grade, play some sort of instrument. I think it'd be great, and whatever instrument they want, whether it's a piano, whether it's a saxophone, it doesn't matter. And in a generation, we would have an American child that could go any place on earth and be at home.
Do you think, compared to when you started in the civil rights movement back in the 60s, how do you feel about of today, what's going on today, to what you were working on back then?
Life is always about the going forward. And I think that I grew up in segregation. And it was really, I had to laugh. I was in Knoxville, Tennessee, I don't know now, 5 years ago, some, you know, it's been a while. And I was invited to speak at the Tennessean Theater, which is there on Gay Street. And it's now historic. But it was so wonderful because I remember when I wasn't during the era of segregation, you weren't allowed. But you can't compare what we did 100 years ago, what we did 50 years ago, and how we're doing it. You have to say, are we engaged in the questions of our time? And are we working, if not to the best of our ability, to some of our ability to try to solve it? Mm-hmm. I think that has to be dealt with. I'm a big fan of Black Lives Matter, because a lot of people have been casual about Black lives. So someone, one lady up in Connecticut said white lives matter too, but nobody said that it didn't. The we've been casual about what happens with Black kids and with Black people. We can look at our prisons and see we have just too many people in prison. And the thing that makes America, and I don't think we're great now, but I think we are on the cusp of a greatness. The thing that makes us potentially great is that we are allowing human freedom. Mm-hmm. That we are in 21st century, we're saying, yeah, you should be able to make some decisions about your life, and I should step back as long as you are a law-abiding citizen. You have a right to live your life. And it's so basic. It has nothing to do with what other people think, because when other people don't like it, they don't have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. It's that simple.
In your speech at Shepherd University, you had mentioned Appalachian happiness is very important. And I wanted to ask you to explore that a little bit more and tell me why you feel that way.
Well, the thing that I admire, I don't know if the term is going to be most, but certainly way at the top of my list, is I admire the fact that you stand for freedom. And I admire the fact that we in Appalachia, and I'm going to include myself in that, have a concept of enough. And that's a concept that we are going to have to actually be able to share and spread across this country, because right now nobody has an idea of enough, which is why people are really being crazy to say, I want to be a billionaire. But actually, $1 million is enough, mm-hmm. maybe even something lower than that. But we in Appalachia have an idea of enough, mm-hmm. that this is... I'm satisfied. I'm pleased. I have a family. I have a decent house. I'm warm. You know, whatever it is, we have a concept of enough. And that idea that Appalachia brings to us, and Appalachia brings it to our country, that idea is what has to permeate. Has to permeate America.
And I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this already, but I'm just going to ask it anyway. Do you feel like you're an Appalachian?
Well, I'm a Knoxvillian by birth, so yes, I am. I don't have any problem with being an Appalachian, but I'm also an American. And I'm also an earthling. And when we look at West Virginia, we are also looking at the future, because almost everything that has to do with space has come from people from this state. And I think that, again, sitting in at night in the dark sky watching it, you know, this is where the dreams come from. And so our rocket people, I mean, you can look at how many of our rocket people are West Virginians who have come from here. They said, well, some want to be an engineer, some want to be poets. You need both. If we're going to go to Mars, you're going to need both.
Thank you so much, Nikki. This interview has been wonderful.
Thank you.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
When we come back, we'll hear from another writer who loves Appalachia, especially these mountains. I'm Jessica Lilly. You are Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
If you enjoy listening to Inside Appalachia, I hope you'll check us out on iTunes and write a review. It just takes a few moments and makes a big difference in getting the word out about the show. We just heard from poet Nikki Giovanni. She says in her online bio that some people called her poetry militant, but she just thinks of her work as good poems. The next author has a similar approach. Anne Pancake might not identify as an activist in a traditional sense, but she recognizes that her work spreads a politically charged message. Anne Pancake always wanted to write about faraway lands, but once she traveled there, she realized the best stories she had were about her home in West Virginia. Her first novel portrays a family living near a mountaintop removal mine. It's called Strange as This Weather Has Been, and it's one of the most popular Appalachian novels of the past decade. Her new collection of stories, Me and My Daddy Listen to Bob Marley, also takes place in West Virginia. She came to Davis and Elkins College in West Virginia recently to talk about the book. While she was visiting, she also sat down with reporter Andrew Carroll to talk about her writing and what it means to be a West Virginian.
Yeah, it's really mysterious. I think it's probably true also for some people in Kentucky and Tennessee, so I think it's Appalachian, but it seems even stronger in West Virginia, this constant pull to come back, but also a constant push to leave.
Writer Anne Pancake now lives in Washington State, but her heart and mind are still in West Virginia. Growing up in Romney, Anne wrote stories about fantasy trips she dreamed of taking outside of West Virginia. Today, however, her focus is much closer to home. Her new book, Me and My Daddy Listen to Bob Marley, continues to focus on the same themes as her earlier works, Given Ground and Strange as This Weather Has Been. She examines closely what it means to be from West Virginia while juggling issues such as generational conflict, drug abuse, and environmental concerns. However, she didn't always think she'd write about West Virginia.
What really turned my head back to West Virginia was when I deliberately left here to find material to write about, and I went overseas to teach. So after I finished at WVU, I went to Japan to teach English, and then I taught English in Samoa and then in Thailand. Then when I got there, I was homesick for West Virginia, and so I was writing a lot of pieces about West Virginia. And I realized that the pieces about West Virginia were you know real stories, as opposed to these sort of voyeuristic stories I was writing about Japan and place, other places that weren't West Virginia. And also being over there taught me that West Virginia actually wasn't boring, that we had, you know, a really interesting culture, a great storytelling tradition, that the way we use language was interesting, and also shed more light on our sense of place. So being really far away from here gave me the perspective to see what we had back here.
Anne's 2007 novel, Strange as This Weather Has Been, tells the story of a family living near a mountaintop removal site in southern West Virginia. Lace moves away from her family and attempts to adjust to life at college, only to return and raise her own family there.
So this section is in the first chapter of the novel, and it's narrated by one of the main characters named Lace, and I think from here on out it's pretty self-explanatory. So when I was in 11th grade and they brought in a guidance counselor from away from here, and I ended up doing work study for her second period. It proved what I'd known all along about my own specialness and how Southern West Virginia was just a holding pen for me. Mrs. Claylock always seemed nervous, and she only lasted 2 years, but in that time, she figured out not only was I smart, but really good at tests. Us cooped up in that supplies closet they gave Mrs. Claylock for an office, cloudy with her strange perfume. I never smelled that perfume again until a department store in North Carolina, and when I did, Mrs. Claylock came so clear I could see the acne scars on her chin. Mrs. Claylock told me how to apply for college. Then she went even further and fixed me up with scholarships and grants. And the day I graduated high school, May 1983, I told myself once I got to WVU, I'd never look back. Truth was, though, after a month away, I was feeling a kind of lonesomeness I'd never known there was. I'd start drinking in my dorm room most evenings, stretch out on my window ledge on the 8th floor of Tower 2, a rum and coke between my legs, or a bottle of Mad Dog 2020. And if anybody asked, I'd say I was just warming up for that night's party. But really, I'd be watching the ridges in the distance. It was like I was all the time feeling I wasn't touching nothing, and wasn't nothing touching me back. And yeah, they had hills in Morgantown, but not back home hills, and not the same feel back home hills wrap you in. I'd never understood that before, had never even known the feel was there, until I left out and knew it by its absence.
So the character Lace realizes that leaving home is just as hard as staying, and thinks this experience is something that many Appalachians can relate to.
You see it in the people, the younger people who are feeling the pull to leave. I think there's a lot of hurt in West Virginia, and there's a lot of beauty in West Virginia. And so to grow up holding both, you know, that beauty and that loss and hurt develops this kind of paradoxical relationship to identity and to land that a lot of us have.
How do you think your novel kind of, any of your works play into that? And do you ever imagine how West Virginians react to reading them? Or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that for me, a lot of my writing is driven exactly by that paradox, the love and beauty that I feel for West Virginia, and also the anger I feel about the way it's treated, and also the hurt I feel for the loss in West Virginia, the things that we experience that hurt us here. The exploitation and the devastation of the environment and some other things, and a lot of the tragedies in our history.
Strange As This Weather Has Been is one of the most read Appalachian novels of the past decade, and rings true for many readers from the region.
And part of the response is because people are interested in reading the documentation of mountaintop removal, but a lot of people respond because they say they've never really seen their language on the page like this before. So people respond to that, to hearing the language that they speak on the page, which isn't something that you see, you know, in novels that aren't written in Appalachia or by Appalachians. Or you also don't see it in novels written about Appalachia by people who aren't from here. So they have that reaction to it. And also, I've had a lot of people talk about, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging on myself, but people have talked about the way that I capture our attachment to the land and our love for the land and the way that I express it. So they also respond to that. And finally, as you know, there's a whole stereotypical way that we're conventionally represented outside of here, and so the fact that I work really hard not to do that in my work, West Virginians respond positively to that too, to see this kind of, and it's not like it's sentimentalized or it's not noble. The people aren't noble in my works, but they're also not they're not caricatures.
So obviously, Strange As This Weather Has Been is a pretty political book in a lot of ways. Is that something you want it to be kind of taken as a piece to, you know, draw people to action, or is that part of who you see yourself as?
I wanted the book to be to educate people and ultimately as a call to action. I also knew that if I wrote it with those as my priorities, it would fail as a novel. You know, it would fail as a piece of art because it would get didactic, it would get preachy, and people wouldn't want to read it. And again, I was lucky for my dissertation. I didn't know I was going to write Strange As This Weather Has Been, but at that time, but I did a lot of research on political novels from the 1930s. A lot of them are pretty flawed as art. I mean, they're social realist novels. And so by reading those, I kind of knew what to avoid in writing a political novel myself to some extent. And what I did was try to always put the priority on the character's experience. And I figured if I could show what it was like to be a person living underneath a mountaintop removal mine, especially a child living underneath one. If I could get that right, then the politics would come through, you know, organically. I didn't need to talk about it in a polemical way. So that's kind of how I went about it.
Anne Pancake's new book approaches social and environmental issues by focusing on the experiences of the characters.
Yeah, this is a story from my new short story collection. Me and my daddy listened to Bob Marley, and there are a couple of sort of explicitly environmental stories in here, and this one's called Rockhounds, and it's about hydrofracking. But again, it's narrated by a child, and I'm going to read a section where her name is Joss, and her dog's run away, so she's trying to find the dog, and she's out in the woods trying to find her dog. She launched herself over the hollow side, slippery with a decade, with more of dead brown leaves. The bank so steep that when she was little, she would lie against it and still be standing up. She slide-angled down, using again the sides of her feet, the thinking part of her hiding to let her body do its knowing, how quick to move, how far to slant, where to step, her strong hips, her calves, even her stomach muscles helping. I'm a deer," she whispered, like she'd done when she was small, as though the saying it itself kept her from falling, and she never did fall. Granddad would be behind her, far more cautious, but still nearly magical in his balance, him catching himself from tree to tree, whooping sometimes after a near miss. Now she landed heavy at the bottom in a leaf drift higher than her knees. "Bunker!" she shouted again. She whistled. The woodpecker ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha'd. She started wading leaves towards the place where the hollow forked, passing right away the boundary between their land and the hackers, white paint slashes fading on trees. She dropped into the bed of a wet weather stream, parched waterless after the summer drought, and she followed that. The run was choked with flat, dark, slaty rocks, sharp under her feet where they stood on end. Of all the things Uncle Derek had told her, that this was the one she could not put away. How the poisons came not only from the stuff they pumped down in, how they came out of the rocks themselves. Things held safe by the earth until the rocks were shattered and the private things unlocked, and then they became poisons too. Then they pull back up out of the well that poison water, and they have to do something with it. Where do you think they dump it, Joss?
That was Anne Pancake reading Rockhampton from her new short story collection called Me and My Daddy Listen to Bob Marley. She was speaking with reporter Andrew Carroll. In just a bit, we're going to hear from fantasy writer Neil Gaiman and Appalachian author Robert Guype, author of a new illustrated novel called Trampoline. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places, as many of you know. Well, it's almost Valentine's Day. Well, all right, Buttercup, it's time to pucker up again. Can you guess a town where you might take your sweetheart for a kiss? Find out after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. Your Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. This week, we're stepping outside of Appalachia just a little bit to Sweet Lips, Tennessee. Did it get its name for a hot little number at a kissing booth? Well, to help us this week, we hear from lifetime area resident Nancy Canada, the Chester County Public Library Director. Thanks so much for helping us out with this week's What's in a Name segment. We just had to find out where Sweet Lips, Tennessee got its name. So what story did you hear growing up?
Okay, of course, Sweet Lips is in the middle of a rural area in the middle of a very rural county. And the story that I always heard was that a traveler was passing through, and of course on foot, and he needed water, and the water that he was given, he said, "This tastes so sweet to my lips." And there is a book that we have in our local library called Passing Gas, and it's about different small towns in America that are very oddly named, and Sweet Lips is in there, and they quote Mr. J.C. Pickett, who ran the Sweet Lips store for years and years, and he said that during the Civil War, there were soldiers that came through, and they were mapping and surveying the area, and they were very thirsty, and they drank out of a stream, and they said, "This tastes so sweet to my lips." So the that area on their maps was known as, became known as Sweet Lips, and it's still that to this day.
Well, now you know how Sweet Lips, Tennessee got its name. If you have another story about Sweet Lips or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag what's in a name.
You could stay here forever, if you want to.
Really?
Sure, we'll sing and play games, and Mother will cook your favorite meals.
There's one tiny little thing we need to do.
What's that?
Well, it's a surprise.
You might remember this popular movie from 2009. Coraline was a story about a girl who dreams of escaping from her realities. And when she does, Coraline discovers life back home with her family is worth fighting her way back to. The book was written by the award-winning author Neil Gaiman. He also wrote Stardust, another blockbuster hit you might have heard of. No, he's not an Appalachian, but one book was inspired by, get this, the old Appalachian folk tales. Yep, the ones we Appalachians are pretty good at telling. The book is called American Gods. Let's listen to what it sounded like read by author Neil Gaiman and some actors.
And along with the milk, the children as they grew drank Essie's tales of the knockers and the blue caps who lived down the mines, of the bucca, the trickiest spirit of the land, much more dangerous than the red-headed, snub-nosed piskies, for whom the first fish of the catch was always left upon the shingle, and for whom a fresh-baked loaf of bread was left in the field at reaping time to ensure a fine harvest. She told them of the apple tree men, old apple trees who talked when they had a mind, and who needed to be placated with the first cider of the crop, which was poured onto their roots as the year turned, if they were to give you a fine crop for the next year. She told them in her mellifluous Cornish drawl which trees they should be wary of, in the old rhyme, "Elm he do brood, and oak he do hate, but the willow man goes walking if you stays out late."
That was a reading from Neil Gaiman's book, American Gods, published by HarperCollins. Gaiman was one of the featured speakers at the West Virginia Book Festival in 2015. West Virginia Public Broadcasting was one of the festival's sponsors. Jesse Wright spoke with Gaiman by phone before the festival to get a little more insight into his work.
Neil Gaiman is primarily a fiction writer. He has crafted vivid characters who inhabit worlds that straddle the familiar and the fantastical. Strands of ancient and modern mythology run through much of his work. Gaiman's love of fantasy is evident in his decades-long collaboration with Appalachian artist Charles Vess, who illustrated the novel Stardust, among many others. Anyone who has an interest in fairies has probably seen his artwork. Gaiman says Vess isn't his only connection to Appalachia, though.
Also, books of mine, like American Gods, in some ways began with my readings of the Appalachian folktales, the strange things that happened, or to my mind, strange things that happened to folktales as they moved from England across the water, and the things that they would keep. They would keep a wit, they would keep the wits, they would keep the triumph of intelligence and of craftiness, but they would lose, they'd lose magic. And that fascinated me. And that actually, in some ways, was the starting point for writing an entire novel, American Gods. And I don't think that people would ever point to that and go, ah, this came out of the Appalachian Jack stories. But in a lot of ways, it did.
Jack tales are a storytelling tradition here in Appalachia, but they shouldn't be confused with your ordinary campfire tale or old wives' tales. They're tall tales that revolve around a trickster character named Jack, who is always plotting some type of mischief. Think Jack and the Beanstalk. The stories are rarely told the same way twice, even by the same storyteller. Jack tales originated in Europe and Britain. As immigrants from those areas came to settle the Appalachian Mountains, they brought Jack along with them. Neil Gaiman's novel, American Gods, revolves around the idea that gods exist because people believe in them, and that when immigrants moved to the New World, they brought their religion or their beliefs with them, and therefore, their spirits and gods came along as well. Like in this scene from the book, where one of the old gods meets a believer in the New World.
There was something about the man that made her happy to look at him, and something else that whispered of danger.
You might say that you know me.
He squinted down at her, and she squinted right back up at him, searching his moon face for a clue to his identity. He looked as young as one of her own grandchildren, yet he had called her by her old name, and there was a burr in his voice she knew from her childhood, from the rocks and the moors of her home.
You're a Cornishman.
That I am, a cousin Jack,
said the red-haired man.
Or rather that I was, but now I'm here in this new world where nobody puts out ale or milk for an honest fellow or a loaf of bread come harvest time.
The old woman steadied the bowl of peas upon her lap.
If you're who I think you are, then I've no quarrel with you.
In the house, she could hear Phillida grumbling to the housekeeper.
Nor I with you. Although it was you that brought me here, you and a few like you, into this land with no time for magic and no place for piskies and such folk.
You've done me many a good turn.
Good and ill. We like the wind. We blows both ways.
Essie nodded.
Will you take my hand, Essie Tregowan?
And he reached out a hand to her. Freckled it was. And although Essie's eyesight was going, she could see each orange hair on the back of his hand glowing golden in the afternoon sunlight. She bit her lip. Then, hesitantly, she placed her blue knotted hand in his. She was still warm when they found her, although the life had fled her body, and only half the peas were shelled.
That was Neil Gaiman and a cast reading from the book American Gods, published by HarperCollins. Gaiman has collaborated with many writers and illustrators during his career. One of the funniest products to come of those collaborations was a book called Good Omens, which Gaiman wrote with fantasy humorist Terry Pratchett. It's a satirical, apocalyptic tale that explores what would happen if the Antichrist were accidentally switched at birth. Although he died of early-onset Alzheimer's disease in March 2015, Pratchett left behind an incredible body of work. He's best known for his 41 Discworld novels, which blend fantasy and humor to satirize the world we live in. Gaiman says he met Pratchett early in his writing career.
I think I was the first journalist ever to interview Terry about his book, The Color of Magic.
The two hit it off right away.
We realized we had the same kind of sense of humor, the same kind of intelligence, and the same kind of knowledge.
The two authors stayed friends and often shared ideas about things they were working on. Gaiman says he had started writing Good Omens, but he had to put it down for other projects. Pratchett called him one day and asked that either he sell him the idea or that they write the book together.
As far as I was concerned, this is an awful lot like Michelangelo calling you up and saying, yeah, do you want to paint a chapel ceiling with me? You know that you're working with a craftsman. You know you're working with somebody who, as far as I was concerned, was a genius. It was like being, you know, apprenticed to a master craftsman. And I would write stuff and I'd send it over to Terry and he'd phone me up. He'd say, you know, if you change this word, it'll be 17% funnier.
Gaiman and Pratchett shared a fondness for libraries. There's even a recurring librarian character in Pratchett's Discworld novels who inhabits a world of books alive with magic. Gaiman has spoken at length in the past about his love of libraries and offered his thoughts about their future in the digital age.
I think the heartbreaking thing about libraries in this era of new technology is they are becoming more important, not less.
Gaiman points out that libraries are often the only places that people who don't have access to the internet can go to connect to the digital world. He also points to the changing role of librarians. they used to serve as navigators in an ocean of printed knowledge.
Information was hard to find. And it was hard to find because it was like a flower growing in a desert. You know, you had a long way to walk, but a librarian could take you to the flower. Now, it's more like flowers growing in the Amazon jungle. You're trying to find a specific flower. Anyone who has spent 5 minutes Googling for information and just sees the amount of noise out there starts to realize that actually somebody who knows what they're doing is incredibly useful. And librarians know what they're doing.
Gaiman once described himself as a feral child raised by libraries. He credits much of his success as a writer to the safe place they provided while he was growing up. Gaiman has advocated for libraries for groups like the Reading Agency, a charity in Britain that supports literacy programs. He does this, he says, because, as he wrote in an article for The Guardian, quote, "everything changes when we read." For Inside Appalachia, I'm Jesse Wright.
I'm Jessica Lilly. You are Inside Appalachia. Today on our show, we've been hearing from writers who love Appalachia. But as we've heard, that love is often mixed up in conflicting emotions. This next guy loves Appalachia too, but it's clear in his novel Trampoline that he's aware of some of the harsh realities of living here. It's about a teenager in eastern Kentucky. Trampoline was published last year, and it's attracted praise from many authors across Appalachia, including Anne Pancake, who we heard from earlier in our program. Anne Pancake wrote, "I fear this book. I'm in love with this book. I'm laughing out loud at this book. I am knocked to my knees in grief by this book. One of the most powerful works of contemporary fiction I've read in years. I'll never forget Don Jewell. I'll never escape Kennard County." Trampoline's author Robert Guype lives in southeastern Kentucky. He's also a professor at Southeast Kentucky Community and Technical College. In this conversation, Guype talks with Roxy Todd about how he based his debut novel on the difficult experiences many young people are dealing with as they're growing up in Appalachia today.
Deep in eastern Kentucky, Dawn Jewell is an angry 15-year-old who lives at the foot of Big Bear Mountain. Her mother is addicted to pills and alcohol, and her father has died in a mining accident. Dawn lives with her grandmother, but that isn't a normal life either because her grandmother has become swept up in an anti-mountaintop removal campaign, and Dawn isn't sure how she feels about any of this.
You know, it's like this is not a life that if she could have chosen any life that she necessarily would have chosen. But it becomes about, well, what do you do when you don't get to choose? What do you do when you don't have a bunch of choices? She's trying to do something that she feels is right. But, I mean, I think that's why she's angry, right? It's like she doesn't want to have to do this. Why can't she be like a kid that doesn't have to deal with all of this? Why can't she just, you know, she often is talking about, why can't I just be normal?
Robert Guype created Dawn Jewell 9 years ago after attending a writer's conference in Kentucky. He decided to buy 2 notebooks and try to fill them with writing over the weekend. He holed away inside a hotel and filled those notebooks with sketches and ideas about Dawn Jewell.
I think the thing is that, you know, she's not typical, but in many ways she is typical of so many young people in the area where I live now.
Towards the beginning of the book, Dawn finds herself speaking up against strip mining at a public hearing. For the remaining pages of the novel, she deals with her contradictory feelings about the attention that people give her because of her words. Some people who work in the coal mines resent her, bully her for speaking out.
She defends her grandmother, but in the process says what she thinks ought to be going on with the environmental protection, and in particular protection of this mountain that's part of their family's history. And so she's not really very comfortable with that and kind of is upset with herself for speaking out. And her reaction to that is she steals several vehicles in succession. And she has a really good guy who's her cousin who works in the coal mines. And he comes and rescues her where she's driven a Oldsmobile off a cliff or out down the side of a bank. And so she takes his truck without his permission, but he comes to get it back with one of his co-workers, and I'll just start there if that's okay. Denny came to pick up his truck with a guy from work. The guy wore a ball cap and looked at me hard. His look said, "I have a life, and it is a good life, a life of laughing and closeness and fun, and you ain't never gonna be a part of it, weirdo tree hugger girl." Mamaw knew the boy. He had been to her house before. She had been to his. Mama had been a school nurse. People knew her that way besides her being a tree hugger. She had saved all kinds of people, all kinds of money on doctor's bills. She had that going for her besides what she was trying to do to stop a strip job. I had nothing going for me besides. There wasn't any well but with me. I was a freak, soft and four-eyed, with black fingernail polish, a dead daddy, a drunk mama, a crackhead brother, outlaw uncles, and divorced grandparents who made trouble for normal people every time they come off the ridge. Denny smiled at me with his eyes. He put his hand out, and I put the keys in it. He nodded and turned to get in his truck. "That's it," his friend said. "Just take the keys and go." "I reckon," Denny said. "Well, I'll be damned," his friend said. Denny opened the truck door. I said, "Well, what would you say if it was your truck?" Mama said, "Don." Denny's buddy turned to faces. "I wouldn't say nothing," he said. "I'd have called the law. I'd had you put in jail, you lawless thing. It wouldn't matter if you was my cousin." "Lawless," I said. "Like when y'all mine off your permit and blast 10 times more than you're supposed to. Build ponds where you ain't got no permit. Lie on your water reports. Lawless like that?" "You need to shut your mouth," Denny's buddy said, "'cause you don't know what you're talking about." "What?" I said. "Break a law on a bulldozer and it ain't a crime." "I work," he said. "That would be something you don't know nothing about, you truck thieving little freak."
At points throughout Trampoline, Dawn is so angry that she keeps running away and stealing cars and beating people up at school. But even she doesn't understand why she's so angry.
If her default is just kind of being aggravated that she's having to process all this, you know, and that she's and that whole push-pull of wanting somebody to talk to about it and just being resentful that, you know, you one, you need somebody. Two, you know, you're afraid to rely on anybody. You know, you're at some level fearful of confiding in anybody. You want contradictory things in the same moment a lot of times.
In the name Trampoline, I know her dad was building a trampoline shortly before he died, and they also had to rescue Dawn's mom with a trampoline, so the trampoline comes back a lot. What does it mean to you?
I think that there's a Joe Henry song called Trampoline, and it's about, it just talks about the idea of jumping so high you never come down, and this whole idea of can you escape, and gravity is a foe, and, you know, there's also the metaphor of, there's some astronaut metaphors in achieving escape velocity from Earth's gravity.
The floor will have its way, it seems. It fights me like a trampoline. It won't let me on the ground. So this time I'm not coming down.
By day, Robert Geip directs the Appalachian program at Southeast Kentucky Community and Technical College in Cumberland, Kentucky, where he helps students record oral histories. He works with the students to then use these oral histories for inspirations in a series of plays called Higher Ground. Geip decided he wanted to write a novel right after the first Higher Ground play launched in 2006. He writes by reading everything over and over out loud.
There's a joy that comes from just the interaction of actually telling stories to each other that still hasn't been topped, and you know, even persists into onto Facebook. That, you know, we're all kind of telling each other what happened that day, and it would be fun to go back to the days of Homer or in some Native American tribe, you know, where people would recite days and days of verse, you know, from memory, just and telling stories that way. I mean, I think that it all should be spoken.
Here's Geip reading later in the same chapter we heard earlier, where Dawn has wandered back into the woods behind her grandmother's house.
Snow and trees gave way to snow and rocks as I climbed. Fresh, I said to myself, everything fresh. Maybe, the wind said to my face, maybe you should cut yourself off on that liquor. I sat on a rock at the crest of the ridge and exhaled. Everything to the north of us sprawled out in front of me. Cut yourself off, I said to the wind. I took out the pipe and the pouch, but I didn't have a lighter. I did not have fire. I stood up to kill myself. I looked down. There was a ledge 10 feet below. I could jump down on that to practice kill myself. I jumped off the mountain.
Spoiler alert, Dawn doesn't kill herself in this book. And Guype says there are two more books coming after this one, featuring Dawn over the next 10 years of her life. But of course, Dawn doesn't know that. Like any 15-year-old, she thinks she has to figure everything out within the next couple of months. She's working on it, aided by the soundtrack that comes to her by her crush, a radio DJ named Willett. Willett plays bands like Velvet Underground and punk rock bands like Black Flag. But Dawn Jewel doesn't have a favorite song.
I think that's exactly right. She'll name these songs, but she's not going to say, that's my favorite song. Because you try and mess it up for her. You'd steal her CD or something. I'm not telling you that. But, you know, really, it's like Dawn doesn't care about that stuff. I mean, I think the thing about her is, it's like, she's just not going to have any favorite music. If I had favorite music, somebody would take it away from me. I mean, I think that that's a big part of, you know, her defensiveness.
It's beyond apathy. It's a choice.
Exactly. It's not apathy. It's just like, you know, you're not going to take anything else away from me.
Trampoline is Robert Guype's first novel. He grew up in Kingsport, Tennessee, and he moved to Kentucky in the 1980s. He's worked as a pickle packer, a forklift driver, and as an educator and radio DJ with Apple Shop and WMMT Radio in Whitesburg, Kentucky. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd.
Trampoline is full of illustrations that were drawn by Guype, and we posted a few of them on our website, as well as information about the book, wvpublic.org. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Sometimes I get weary hearing the news. Really no news at all.
Now, for the final part of our show, in honor of Valentine's Day, we'd like to play you one more story about love and Appalachia. Two summers ago, a group of young people gathered in Kentucky for a conference called STAY. Stay Together Appalachian Youth. Stay has an ongoing project called Appalachian Love Story, where they collect interviews from young people about whether they want to stay in Appalachia, and what they like and what they wish they could change about Appalachia. Back in 2014, Ashley Henderson sat down with a volunteer for Stay named Rance Garrison to talk about her love story for Appalachia. Ashley was in her late 20s at the time.
Do you see yourself staying in the South or in the Appalachian region? And if so, what moment in your life caused you to make that choice?
That is a good question. I think it's interesting. If you had asked me that question in 2003, mm-hmm. I probably would have been like, I'm out. I'm leaving. Like, what's here other than, like, my family, a few friends that's going to keep me here? Like, what jobs am I going to be able to get? You know, what's the point? And I think that, like, now looking back 10 years later, I am sure I will be buried in these hills. And I think it's exactly what's supposed to happen. Like, I think that's exactly where I'm meant to be.
Ashley Henderson is from Chattanooga, Tennessee. But some of her favorite memories growing up were visiting her grandparents in a rural agricultural community called Summit. She remembers it as a community where people often shared food from their garden with their neighbors, a place where people often made do with very little money.
I would go and visit them and my brother and I, you know, at times even like stayed and lived with my grandparents in Summit. And one of the things that they were really committed to was that we weren't going to be those kids that just sat inside and watched TV all day. And so one of the things that they would do is like layer us up and send us out to go play. And I think the time that I really connected with the land and the place that my people were from and that I was being raised in was, you know, being out in those woods and learning about what grew on that land and really building relationships with the other, especially young people that also treasured and valued that space.
A lot of people Ashley's age are leaving Appalachia, and she's left too. She traveled to be an activist and an organizer for communities across the globe, but in the end, something brought her back home.
I've gotten to travel all over this country. I've gotten to organize in Mexico, and I've been in Jamaica. You know, I've gone outside the borders of this country. And I think what I realized was that while I was out, you know, saving everybody else's folks, which are also my folks, right? Mm-hmm. while I was out doing this world-saving work everywhere else, like, there were needs where I'm from.
Ashley says traveling helped her find her real mission in life.
You know, because of that realization that I had while I was outside of these hills, that I've decided that I'm going to stay, I'm going to dig in roots, I'm going to make it sustainable for me and for my family and my friends and the people that I love to be able to continue to stay here and keep the kind of culture and great, wonderful things that, you know, whether it's just how this place looks or what we eat or how we talk or the way that we learn, like, how do we make the best of it and make it sustainable for us to continue to spread that legacy to generations after us is really important to me. So I'm absolutely staying.
Ashley Henderson calls herself an Afrolatian, a combination of African-American and Appalachian. These days, she's an activist for an organization called Project South in Atlanta, which organizes for racial and economic justice.
Come on. Keep your mind on it. And I hear you clapping. Don't give up on it. Oh, you're talking about the new world coming through. Keep your mind on it. Shine your light on it.
Thanks for listening to our Appalachian Valentine. You know what I love? Going on vacation. Getting the heck out of here. But when I come up I-77, I know that home isn't too far away. There's a certain sense of security and comfort with these mountains. It's not perfect, we have our flaws, but true love takes the good with the bad and finds beauty in flaws. We heard from some writers with a love for this place, too, and recognize some things they might not agree with. But when you love someone, you don't just give up on them. We'd love to hear your Appalachian love letter, or perhaps a haiku poem. Just send us a tweet at InAppalachia and use the hashtag MyAppalachia. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia.
I wanna be with you. I can give you love that's true. Just believe the way I feel. I love you and I always will. No one can take your place with me.
Music in today's show was provided by Andy Agnew Jr., Ben Townsend, Eric Bibb with New World Coming Through as heard on Mountain Stage, Jake Sheps, the Glenville State Bluegrass Band, and our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.